Hi, it's Karen Webster, and welcome to The Matchmaker is In. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Vaughn, the CEO of Saucy. Chris, thanks for joining me today from LA, I should add.
Thank you, Karen. I appreciate it.
So from Boston, LA sounds delicious at this time of the year, but let's talk about your business. Saucy, it's reinventing the way consumers purchase and have alcohol delivered, which is an interesting business. It's a very tricky business given all the state liquor laws and regulation that goes around it. And that's one of the things that we'll explore today as we talk about what drove you to create Saucy and some of the lessons you've learned along the way of igniting it. But let's start at the beginning. Why were you motivated to take on what is a very complicated and hard to solve business at scale?
Well, I think in the very beginning, which is very much how we still think about the business today, it all started with customer behavior. So we sort of came to the industry with a very naive look at how it functioned, the regulatory environment, everything else, and just started with how do people buy this product? And that, for the founders, started with us. We just looked at how the majority of time we were purchasing alcohol, it would just be, you know, you're on your way home from work or you're hanging out with, you know, your significant other, your wife, or whatever it may be, and probably 80%+ of the time that we were buying, we always just went to whatever the most convenient option was. And we really didn't care who that was or where it was. You know, it didn't matter if it was, you know, the grocery store or a corner store or out here a big chain is called BevMo. It was just, okay, 80% of the time, get whatever you can the most convenient way. And so how do we solve that? First, let's take a look and see if that's how other people shop in this category. And then second, if there's a big opportunity here, let's solve for that shopping behavior. And then the regulatory side and really learning about the market and the industry and everything else is what came immediately after that. That's when we said, okay, this is the primary buying decision in the market. Let's build something here, but we know it's a heavily regulated industry. The first thing we should do before we start building any technology or anything is start sitting down with regulators and figure out what are their problems in the industry. Not just how do we do this in compliance or whatever, but there's probably some real issues in an industry that is so old. And how do we actually help provide more visibility or better tools for what the future of this space can be?
So there are two sides to your business. You actually enable the purchase online like any other e-commerce site would offer. So I can go onto your site or in your app and I can pick something and have it shipped to me. And in local markets, and you have a number of them that you've actually launched in, you work with retail partners to create a match between a local store and a consumer in that geography that can actually get the product they want delivered to them, your website says, in 30 minutes or less. So what came first, the online delivery or the local retail partnerships matching with consumers in a neighborhood?
What started was how do we find out of those regulatory conversations, it was very clear that if you're going to do this, you need to partner with existing retailers, and you can get their inventory up online. And when a customer shops, they're shopping from that local retailer, and then you need to get that product to the customer some way, somehow. I think for us in LA, that became very clear. We went out and started talking to 30, 40 retailers and understanding their business. And, you know, some of them had signs that said, you know, free delivery. So we went to those guys first and they're like, delivery is really not a business for us. I get maybe 3 or 4 orders a month. You know, I can have my extra clerk run out when those rare things come in or whatever. So it became very clear that there wasn't a delivery infrastructure in the market. I will say that the first huge group of retailers we spoke to all said no. I think because mm-hmm. delivery wasn't a business for them.
Right.
They're like, oh, I do deliveries. And yeah, I get no orders. So this doesn't make any sense to me, or I don't trust internet companies or whatever it may be. And, you know, we finally found a retailer that guy's in his early 30s, inherited the store from his dad. Not even 60 seconds into talking to him, he was basically like, this sounds awesome, let's do it. And he was our first ever retail partner in West Hollywood. And, you know, he's like, the one caveat is, I'm not going to do delivery. You know, you guys mm-hmm. have to figure that out. And so early on, the founders did all the deliveries. We delivered at least the first 1,000 or so orders on the platform. But that taught us a ton about how you're getting in and out of stores, how you need to batch or group orders together to be efficient. It was the source of information that informed most of what we've built over the next couple of years. It's just, how do you be super efficient with delivery? One, to make the economics in this business work, but two, so that we could provide the best solution to any retailer and then subsequently to any customer. We also tried early on partnering with another store who was very well known in the area for delivery. They actually had 2 delivery vans. They had, I think, 4 delivery people, and ran a trial that way. And what we discovered after not even, I think, 3-4 weeks of operating is that there was no way customers were going to be happy with the service if we relied on these other people to do it. It was just, some orders would go well. Some orders that were supposed to be, you know, under an hour would be an hour and 20 minutes. Some orders he just had to cancel altogether because his drivers were busy on other deliveries. And it was like, if we're having these problems today, you know, sending this guy a handful of orders a day, there's no way we're going to be able to scale a business to the point where we could send a retailer hundreds of orders a day. And even someone with delivery vans and delivery people, there's no way he's going to handle that. So we knew very early on we had to build a logistics company that partnered with local retail.
And so do you operate the delivery trucks yourself, or are there third parties you align yourself with to do the deliveries?
So we run a delivery platform very similar to, I'd say, Uber or Instacart or, you know, a lot of these other players, which is, you know, couriers can sign up to be on the platform. We really look for couriers that have a professional background as a courier or drive from multiple services. We found mm-hmm. that they are just much better at navigating a city. And we have a little over 3,000 couriers on the platform now. But it's a way where couriers can jump on. They can pick up orders. They love the platform because of how we've structured delivery. I'd say our average courier does a little over 2.2 deliveries an hour, because when they go pick up from the store, they're never just picking up one order. Chances are they're picking up 3-4 people's orders, which is very different from food delivery. Like if they were driving on Postmates or something, they're picking up pizza and bringing it to me. They're picking up sushi and bringing it to you. They're averaging sort of one pickup per location and then making that delivery, which makes, obviously, the economics tough. It means you need far more couriers on the platform to handle volume. But, you know, we've really designed something that's specific to picking up from centralized locations and delivering out to customers. And we've optimized that so that couriers can do a lot of orders per hour and subsequently make a lot of money by choosing to drive on the platform.
So how do you make sure that your couriers are delivering to customers that are of legal age? What kinds of tools do you provide them in order to make sure that they don't violate the local laws, local and federal laws, and get you guys into trouble?
Yep. That was actually one of the first questions we asked the regulators before we launched as a company, was what's the policy on ID verification? And the policy was basically, don't sell alcohol to people under 21. And the general guidance is if someone looks under 30 or 35, check their ID. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, I could show you pictures of five people right now, and you'd have no clue who's 30 or 19 or whatever, right? That's extremely subjective. So what we built from the very beginning, and we're the only platform that does this, is we built into the driver application that every single order, doesn't matter if this person's ordered before, it doesn't matter if the person is 100 years old, an order cannot be completed without both checking and scanning an ID, and then the scan on that ID matches that record back to the person who placed the order. We're in effect stricter than any retailer in the country. We've seen other delivery platforms, you know, provide the option of checking for someone's birthday or the option of checking for an ID. But we consistently shop other people that have worked in this space, and I'd say I've had my ID checked less than 20% of the time. A lot of that comes down to it's just not required in the courier's drop-off. So the courier, again, is using his subjective opinion to say, this guy looks like he's old enough. Sure, I'm not going to use the app. Or, they look young, you know. But that obviously leads to problems. So we require it on every order. We keep transactional records. Every morning I have a report on my desk that shows all the orders from yesterday matched to an ID scan for every single order. It's one of the ways that we're helping provide more visibility in an industry traditionally plagued by underage drinking. We took other precautions as well when we launched. We carved out college campuses and just said, you know, maybe there's big drinking communities there, but that's not how we're going to build our business. And we saw, conversely, a lot of the competitors in space built their business by going to fraternities and sororities and being very fratty and stuff like that. I'd say from the very beginning, you know, we just weren't willing to say, hey, we're going to chance, you know, delivering to someone under 21 just for the sake of a sale. And we're going to be stricter than anybody else. And I honestly feel like it's a better customer experience. You know, if you've ever been at a bar or restaurant and you're sitting there and then they ask, oh, can I see your ID? It's this weird, like, you feel like you're under investigation or something, right? Compared to if you just knew that to buy alcohol, you had to present your ID every time, there would be no awkward exchange. And that's where we sit.
So your ID verification application must also be good enough to spot fake IDs and spoofing, right?
Correct. Fake IDs, spoofing, expired licenses, all those things. Of course, you know, we're not naive to the fact that, you know, I mean, we've seen fake IDs out on the market that are real. They are real from the DMV. Right. So, I mean, we, you know, watch for all those things very carefully, but I'd say that, you know, more than any retailer or anybody else, we're being more proactive than anybody else out there.
So Chris, you started with talking to regulators to understand where the speed bumps would be. Then you knew that you had to acquire retail partners. Given the way the industry is structured, obviously with those retail partners, you can put their inventory up online, people can order it, have it delivered, but the real core of the business is delivery. Help us understand how you got that first geography up and going. What did you do once this 30-year-old retail partner said, yes, let's go? How'd you bring customers on board?
So early on, I mean, we had very limited budgets. We hadn't raised any capital at the time, and it was just how do we make as much noise as humanly possible? And I think we had a philosophy that we keep today, which is give people something to talk about. You know, anybody can just acquire people on Facebook or, you know, use different social channels or, you know, all sorts of different things you can do in terms of digital customer acquisition. But we just have this concept that if you deliver alcohol to somebody, good chance that they're drinking it with someone else. If you do it in a cool and interesting way, or if you're really fast, they're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And if you do that reliably and consistently, you're going to have a very large word-of-mouth business. And so early on, we coupled that with sort of wild and crazy activations, which may seem, you know, sort of out there, but they got us millions of press impressions for free. You know, some of the things we did is we partnered with the Sinatra family and Jack Daniels. And on Sinatra's birthday in December, if you ordered Jack Daniels, we had Frank Sinatra impersonators going out delivering alcohol to people singing Christmas carols.
That's awesome.
I'd say a more risque thing we did is we partnered with another LA company called MeUndies, and they have the world's most comfortable underwear. And we made these sleepover packs in the app where if you ordered a sleepover pack, it was delivered by guy and girl underwear models out to people's homes. And people lost their minds, but that got us 75, 80 million press impressions in a week for free.
That's awesome.
And then we backed that up with marketing things that I think people react to. I think I've always had this pushback within the investors, or not our investors, but the investor community, where they're like, show me how you scale up Facebook spend to X, Y, Z. And I'm like, right. When was the last time you heard about your favorite service in a Facebook ad?
Right.
That's not how you heard about it, right? So for us, we've always had this philosophy as to how do you drive word of mouth? How do you give people something to talk about? How do you deliver more than alcohol to them? How do you deliver plans to them or something that they can go do? And I think we've always thought about our category being alcohol as it's just sort of this underlying social lubricant in our society. And it's not about, I think if you look at the traditional retailers in the space, they do advertising very poorly. It's all very, we have Tito's vodka on sale for $18.99, come get it. We have Jack Daniels at a price discount, and here's a coupon, come try it. Mm-hmm. People aren't drinking Tito's and Jack Daniels because you have it for $18.99. People are drinking Tito's and Jack Daniels because they're hanging out with friends, because they're having people over for dinner, because they're going out with buddies. And so if you structure your marketing and messaging much more in alignment with understanding what people are doing, I think that you have a message that really carries. And I think that's very different from something like the grocery category. Grocery very much is eggs are on sale, bananas are on sale, milk's, you know, whatever. But it's different with alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was for a time, this is going back some in the grocery stores, there was Elvira selling Halloween stuff. Remember that? I mean, that was about as creative as the grocery category got. But back to the brand, you made a good point about tying a lot of what you're doing to a brand. So the Sinatra family and Jack Daniels. How are the brands responding to your ability to perhaps influence not only sales to existing customers, but getting new customers to try?
I mean, they love it. I think that we've done, when we work with the brands, again, I think we've seen competitors in the space say, yeah, you can pay us to feature you in a category, or you can pay us to, put a little highlight around your product. That definitely works, and that definitely affects buying behavior. But obviously, you're not really connecting with the customer in a new and interesting way. You know, we think of ourselves a little bit more like we have an internal agency that works with these brands on, because we're going to be at the customer's door, how do we connect that experience all the way through to them? And we just did something with Cazadores, and they just had a custom bottle made by a famous tattoo artist called Mr. Cartoon, and we went out and filmed a whole bunch of content with him. Around the creation of the bottle, the experience. You know, we're not just saying, oh, Cazadores, top of the menu, check it out, but featuring content to those customers. We've created different custom T-shirts with Mr. Cartoon that are available in the app, and all of these things is telling a very different brand story about Cazadores in a way that people just didn't know. To them, it was just another tequila option. So I think that we've also viewed, as retail has not advertised brands well, obviously because there's barriers there, I would say that the brands have done a great job of their communication through on-premise, through bars and restaurants. Mm-hmm. Come here, it's a great, you know, feeling environment, you know, this is how you'll feel and interact with us. But that completely falls off at brick and mortar retail. And mm-hmm. for us, it's about, again, connecting that brand tone and that brand experience all the way through to the consumer.
Tell me a little bit about those consumers. What can you tell us in terms of the demographics? Are these young, old, across all age groups? And do they perceive themselves as being part of a community versus someone who uses an app to buy stuff?
So starting with demographics, yeah, I mean, I'd say, one, we're obviously primarily an app or a web-driven business, so our biggest demographic is 25 to 35-year-olds. Second to that is 35 to 45-year-olds, and then third is 21 to 25. It's almost completely dead split between male and female, which both retailers, brands, and everybody else, I think, is very surprised at. But when we talk to our customers, we start to see why. We've heard from lots of women that they just feel more comfortable shopping this way. They don't like going out to a liquor store. We've even heard from a large percentage of women that they felt uncomfortable buying alcohol with their groceries at the grocery store. And so they order it through the app. I think in terms of a community versus just an app, that really comes down to the experience you deliver to them. You know, another report that's on my desk every morning is a list of anyone who experienced a delivery that went over 45 minutes. You know, I think that if you consistently deliver fast alcohol, that's an incredible experience. The second you start getting into the over an hour range, people may not complain about it. You may not have a customer support ticket or anybody, you know, say anything or whatever. But that's just the realm where I could have run out to the store. You know, if I wanted this bottle of wine, you know, over 80% of wine consumed in the U.S. is consumed within hours of being purchased. So shipping wine to you, things like that's a very limited percentage of how people buy. But if I want a bottle of wine or I'm halfway through dinner and I want something to drink and I can press a button and it shows up in an average delivery time is 32 minutes, that's an incredible experience. If you deliver to me in an hour, hour and a half, a little bit later, it's like, okay, that was convenient, but I also could have just ran out to the grocery store. And I think we've heard from some of our competitors in the space, they're like, no, people don't care about, you know, delivery in under an hour. That's not the business. And, you know, people just want to be able to order and they'll drink it whenever they can. And we've just found that is blatantly not the case. And I think it might be convenient for them to say that because they don't actually handle delivery. But we found you deliver alcohol quickly to somebody, that's a delightful experience. They feel like they're a part of something. They feel like they're part of the Saucy family or community. And I think that's why they recommend their friends so often to our service.
How do you decide what new markets to open? What goes into that decision?
So for us, we looked at alcohol as a category and said, how have the largest players in this industry won or dominated the market? You know, Southern Wine and Spirits or Southern Glaziers, Anheuser-Busch as a brand, you know, BevMo, Total Wine, et cetera. And what we've seen is that the best players really have done it by dominating markets. You know, Costco and Walmart sell more alcohol than any other retailer, but not by much, right? There's 180, 190 million people that visit Walmart stores every day. Mm-hmm. But Walmart only sells maybe three times as much alcohol as BevMo, which is predominantly just in California cities.
Wow.
So I think this concept of, like, you look at Uber, you look at these other services, and it's, oh, you got to be in every corner of the country, you got to be as far out from every city as possible, that's the big opportunity. That, no, over 60-65% of alcohol consumption is in 10 states. The majority of the populations consuming that alcohol is in the cities of those states. LA is estimated to sell over $5 billion of alcohol out of brick and mortar retail. And that's just LA proper. So if you look at how you own and dominate retail or the consumer buying behavior in this category, it really is first and foremost, how do you dominate California as a market, which we have done, right? New York is the second biggest market, which I think Minibar has done very well. Third and fourth, and sort of switching around, is, depending on the category, is Texas and Florida. But I think until you go really deep in those markets, these services that are just launching another state, another city, another place, and that, I think they're trying to hit some sort of basic top-line revenue goal. But again, you know, Total Wine is in 16 states, but very concentrated near specific cities. They sell, what, over almost $3 billion of alcohol. That's pretty close to Walmart. Costco sells close to four, and they're all over the place in this giant megastore. You know, BevMo sells close to probably about $1 billion, predominantly in California. So if you focus on the primary markets, and more particularly the urban areas of those markets, you're going to own the customers in this industry. And that's really what the battle's for. And so for us, we're not interested in spreading. You know, let's imagine you have $10 to spend on marketing. I'd rather put that all into a few markets that really control the buying behavior here, compared to, I'm going to spread $10 across 50, 60, right, you know, cities.
So that's a good segue in the time we have left to Amazon and Whole Foods. You know, everyone does talk about, you know, the Amazon effect on just about everything that's sold in retail and certainly food and beyond. And they announced that they're shutting down Amazon Wine for concerns over, you know, regulatory issues given the acquisition of Whole Foods. But there's a lot of discussion about how Whole Foods does give them a platform, brick and mortar, to disrupt the purchase and delivery of alcohol. Where do you stand on that?
Absolutely. I would say, again, at the end of the day, this all comes back to the consumer, right? Why has Instacart been so successful in capturing grocery delivery customers when there's Amazon Fresh?
Mm-hmm.
My answer would be, have you gone to Amazon Fresh's app or website? It's Amazon is terrific for shopping for consumer electronics and looking for something very specific and adding that thing or all sorts of other categories, but they have not figured out grocery. That's right. Not from a customer shopping perspective. It is very cumbersome to put together a grocery list on Amazon. Their delivery experience is killer, and they have everything that I want in stock, and they've nailed it. But from a shopping perspective, it's very difficult. And we've seen the same thing in our category. You know, one of our larger partners is BevMo. We started to put tremendous numbers on the board for BevMo, and so they reached out and started working with Instacart and DoorDash. And the big question of all of our investors forever and other potential investors has been, what if Instacart does it? What if DoorDash does it? Well, they've been trying to do it for over 2 years now. And what we've seen is any retailer that works with DoorDash that we want to work with, they'll drop DoorDash in a second to work with us. We've seen that Instacart, when they do alcohol delivery, it's very unusual shopping behavior. The customers are most typically buying snacks, water, cups, small cart sizes. It's just a different shopping experience. And I think the same with Amazon. You know, we've seen Drizly like to compare themselves as, we are the Amazon competitor here, just as Instacart is the Amazon competitor in grocery. Well, first I'd say Instacart is a huge logistics company that handles delivery across all these markets to customers. Drizly is an ordering platform. They don't deliver anything to anybody. So they're relying on all these independent guys to basically mm-hmm. execute on the customer experience. Mm-hmm. Second, I'd say Amazon has tried alcohol delivery for over 2 years now, and mm-hmm. in LA, San Diego, a lot of our markets. And what we've seen is that they have really struggled to build it as a category. Of course, that can always change. They can always refocus how the app experience is, how the shopping experience is. But I think people who focus too much on just the B2B side or distribution or who you're partnering with or all these things, what they tend to lack focus on just what does that customer feel like, how easy is the experience for that one person. And people who have not built a shopping experience specific to alcohol have not been able to penetrate the category.
Mm-hmm. So final question, Chris, for Thanksgiving. What are some of your interesting experiences? Are you going to have turkeys deliver alcohol or something fun like that?
We'll see. You know, Thanksgiving's always a fun time of year. It's, you know, there's the big drinking day of the year, the night before Thanksgiving. But, yes. I mean, we definitely see huge spikes in wine. We see people starting to pick up gifting for the holiday season. You know, Thanksgiving is more of a family time of year, though. I'd say our big, big days are Halloween, Christmas, New Year's, things like that. But
we'll
have some fun things coming out.
I ask because living in Boston and on the Freedom Trail, which is where our offices are, we see pilgrims walking around all the time. So seeing a pilgrim knock at our door probably wouldn't be a thrill. However, I'm sure in California people would wonder, well, maybe they wouldn't. You know, what is this person dressed strangely doing at my front door with a bottle of wine? Chris, yeah. It was really great to get to learn about the business and how you've built it. It's an interesting approach. It is a logistics business that is focused on the customer experience, and the word of mouth aspect of this, I think, is really fascinating. Congratulations and continued good luck to you.
Thank you, Karen. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris. And thanks to everyone who listened today. We'll see you next time. Thank you.